The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris with my co-host Dave Willingham and Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson. Tonight, we're really happy to welcome actor and activist Teresa Williams, who is on the board of the Whatcom Human Rights Task Force. Teresa, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So the Whatcom Human Rights Task Force has been in existence since the 90s, one of the longest, if not the longest, human rights organization in Whatcom County. For people who might not know about it, do you want to give sort of a brief who you are and what you do?
Sure. The Whatcom Human Rights Task Force, well, we meet monthly and we go over different ways to engage the community. We're doing the Martin Luther King Day Human Rights Conference that's coming up. And we're also starting new programs. We created subcommittees. We're trying to get people from the public to come to our meetings. We're open to everyone, students, and we're really interested in making sure everyone within the local community knows their rights, knows how to unite and gather together, and just knows there's something available for you to do.
So as we talk on this show, often our community with as much as we like to say subdued excitement, but I think there's a dark underbelly, and there's been human rights issues and attacks for decades, if not in our entire existence. One of the recent issues that people have been very passionate about was the vote on the jail. And I am wondering if you thought that the fact that it got voted down was a good thing.
Well, I think it was a good thing. The jail issue has many different aspects. And currently, I feel we should focus more on engaging people before they go to jail, creating different systems within the community that they can have access to. The money and funds should go towards that, not more incarceration, not a money-making machine. It should go towards preventing people from going to jail, and also if they happen to go to jail, once they get out, rehabilitation programs and housing and jobs.
Right. I guess my big concern about the jail issue going into the election was that its approval is therefore a rubber stamp of policies as usual. And I think that there was a real swell and undercurrent and tide pushing forward that business as usual with regards to criminal justice, social justice, those kinds of issues, they need to be rethought. They need more attention delivered to them.
Right. Rather than the business as usual, as you said, to focus on a better solution, totally different solutions.
Well, one of the things that we've talked about a lot in terms of the jail is the Vera report that found with the Whatcom County Jail a lot of inequity, a lot of inequality, a lot of as some people have been saying, and some organizations have been saying, targeting of different backgrounds, and particularly Native Americans and Asian and Black people in comparison to our population. So I'm wondering if the Whatcom Human Rights Task Force does any work around that in terms of education or activism?
Okay, currently we're still gathering together on the reinstitution of new committees and old committees that now become new committees, and so we're working towards that. But I am aware of that the targeting, or if targeting isn't the word, then it's a systemic thing, and so that is something we will look into and put on our list. We have a long list of issues.
Right. I guess I just will report that this week at Whatcom County Council, the final report from the Justice Task Force came forward, and Jill Bernstein, who's been on our show and who's just an absolutely fabulous representative of that task force, delivered, you know, the task force perception of what it of what's occurred in criminal justice to the Whatcom County Council, and included in that was the Vera report. And I think one of the the less understood and underreported aspects in the Vera report was this idea that there's a racial disparity operational in Whatcom County Jail. In other words, people of color are overrepresented per 100,000 in Whatcom County Jail. The reasons for that were not well described in the Vera report. They just simply said that this is a concern in communities across the country, and it needs to be examined in greater detail. And they didn't say that, you know, well, Whatcom County Jail discriminates against people of color, but they said it's a red flag. I mean, why are people of color so disproportionately represented in the jail? And it's an issue that they didn't give a lot of detail on, but it's something that they encouraged that Whatcom County would study.
Right, right. That is a real problem, especially since if you look at the population here, it's a disparity already in the people of color that live here. Mm-hmm. So that should not be happening at all. That's something I will bring to the committee's attention. Well, it's already in the air, but it will be brought to the attention that is going on.
I'm glad to hear that, and I'm glad to hear that you guys are working on it. I mean, Tim, you say it, and this is not about you. This is in the statements that this is a concern. This is a concern that communities are facing around the country. It's an indictment. I mean, come on, this isn't okay. You know, you see those numbers like that. There's no concern there. If I was selling donuts and every 10th person that bought one died, that's not a concern. I mean, this is ruining people's lives, and it shows that there is something fundamentally wrong in our justice system, that this can happen. And so I'm glad to hear that you're continuing work on that, because I've been a little afraid that all of that would be lost. It would be like, oh, well, we voted the jail down, so we don't have to think about that anymore.
Till next time.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, the caveat of the Vera Institute was on this particular issue is that, you know, in a community that is so predominantly white, like Whatcom County, and jail statistics are factored in numbers of 100,000, that you get sort of statistical errors when you're dealing with small populations within that 100,000 range. And I, the way that I guess I would express it is, if a person of color, let's say a Lummi native, is arrested for multiple offenses, that has a statistical impact on their data. In other words, you know, one or two Lummi natives being arrested has a statistical impact on their data collection. That's not representative at all of how many people from Lummi Nation, let's say, are involved in the criminal justice system. Right. If that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, statistics, sure. It's sample size is what you're talking about.
Yes.
On the other hand, one could argue, and I might argue, that there are plenty of white people who have recurring offenses. And so, theoretically,
correct,
that might even out a little bit. But I want to go back to Dave's point about it being an indictment rather than a concern. I think it's an excellent point. It may be the Institute's business to raise concerns, but it is our community's business to not be concerned. And I think concern is a white person word that, to me, like, conjures up a lot of hand-wringing and does not advocate for change.
That was well expressed.
well, thank you, Tim. And so, but it was originally, it is Dave's point, but anyway, taking that back to the Human Rights Task Force, and I think we should step back a little bit because we're hitting you with, what are you doing about this? What are you doing about that?
Okay.
And I don't think we've explained to people, you know, let's just step back and look at the history of the task force, because I'll just say I was on the steering committee way back in the 90s with Damani mm-hmm. Johnson and part of the, I didn't form it, but I was one of the first steering committee members. And it formed in response to a cross burning
right.
in Whatcom County. I don't. Were you in Whatcom at the time?
I wasn't here at the time.
Good for you.
Yeah, I'm glad I wasn't.
But part of the history that I want to share, and it was very prevalent. The Joining Hands Against Hate has been around since the 90s, but I think with other issues, it sort of kind of maybe petered out a little bit,
right.
And I think sort of became went under the wings of the
Peace and Justice Center. It did, and it's just been a reemergence of late with the advent of the chaotic transitions going on and politics and the world, you know, today. So it's been a resurgence and a regrouping together, and that's what we've been doing. We've had several meetings throughout, but it's just been recently. So we're banding closer.
So I guess before we start saying, well, what are you doing about this? And what are you doing about that? Because mm-hmm. apparently it's the Whatcom Human Rights Task Force's responsibility to fix everything. You didn't know that when you walked into the room. But what happened to sort of encourage or spark this reemergence and this re-strengthening mm-hmm. of the task force?
Well, from my understanding, it's people that were in the task force already or that approached it that felt an urge to make a change or do something or respond to the current state of affairs in this nation. And so it was this urge and this feeling of helplessness and what do we do? And so, you know, we have this task force and, you know, let's focus on it. Let's get real actions going, you know. And so that's what we've been focusing on. What can we do, you know, feet on the ground? It's interesting trying to make that happen.
Is it your perception that interest in the Human Rights Task Force might have increased over the past year because of maybe some, I don't know how to quite express this, but
Nazis.
Some things,
let's say Nazis.
Yes,
Nazis.
Things that have occurred on the national level that descend and particulate down into Whatcom County politics.
Elections.
As well.
Elections, right.
Yes, and just a general rank.
Are you coming back because of Trump?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
I see what you're saying. Yes. And it's so funny. I'm glad you asked me that. And it's like I'm sitting here and I'm trying to put my toe in the water and see where this is going. But it's good for me not to be so hesitant and not to be so vague and not to be so, you know, I don't know what's happening here. I'll just say these words that sound okay. I joined the task force not too long ago. I wasn't in the original wave of members, and I joined because of the recent events that have been happening. I'm younger than some of the members, and I felt a sense of helplessness, and I didn't want to fall into cynicism and, you know, just feeling like there's nothing I can do, and oh, I'll just put my head in the sand. You know, it's like, what can I do? So this task force was available, and so, and it is for my personal involvement, it is in response to Trump, and it is in response to the increase in hate crimes and increase in the very volatile atmosphere and aggressive atmosphere, you know, that we're all experiencing.
Right. Do you feel comfortable sharing any bit of your personal story that led you to this moment?
Oh, yeah, sure. I can share that. I'm an artist and a writer, and I'm of the sort that I tend to, okay, for a while I was was doing the artist thing. I was like, I'm gonna write over here. I'm not gonna involve myself so much in so-called politics, you know. And I'm a Black woman. I'm a multicultural woman. You know, I'm a single parent. I'm technically still a student, you know. So I have all these different hats that I put on. I've also experienced, you know, racism and prejudice here in Bellingham. And classism, if that's the right word. And so all of these things are like, you know, circling around me. And, all you know, it's very positive things, too, as we all know here in Bellingham. So things got very local with me. You know, we're always local and personal, but sometimes we talk about politics and it gets to be like, oh, out here in the nether region, you know. But things got really personal faster and more in depth with this political era since Trump was elected and during his campaign. You know, it's not to say that it wasn't that I didn't experience these negative things before, but it heightened. It's still heightening. I walk outside sometimes, and I it's like what am I supposed to do? And it's all I can do is to go to the task force meeting. I do the social media campaign. I try to hold myself together. I'm there for my son. My son is Black. He's 8 years old. You know, what do I do? So I'm going to the task force. Sometimes I do feel that, like, what are we doing here? We're on these committees, you know. But then I have to, I'm reassured by the small changes. That was a long speech. I'm sorry.
It was a good speech.
Well, normally I'd ask something along the lines of, you know, how do you plan on sustaining this energy? But I have a feeling that you're going to get a lot of fuel for that. So I'd like to ask about, you talked about the small changes. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Small changes.
The personal is political. You can answer that any way that it comes
up. I was thinking about this earlier because I knew I was coming on this radio show. I said, okay, part of my brain said, what can I say to inspire someone or this and that? And it's like,
it's all on you, Tracy.
Yeah, I know. I must change the world. And I think that's where not only myself, but I think all of us can fall into that. It's a trap. My goal isn't to inspire, I don't know how to say it correctly, but I had to stop and say, what am I doing for, what small changes as far as what am I doing for me? What can I say for me? You know,
I know we have a lot of questions, but I'm going to go into the weeds intentionally for a second, mm-hmm. because I think you just hit something that's so crucial to all of us that is transcendent of everything we're talking about tonight. You said, what can I do to inspire? I feel like one of the deepest core issues that it is affecting any of us who are pained by our current circumstances is a sense of debilitation. Not only we have to inspire other people, like you've just said, but that we can't do anything.
Right.
And if you don't mind, because you brought that up, I think that that's one of the biggest things we're all facing.
Mm-hmm. I believe so. And exactly. I was thinking about this all this morning. And it's like, you know, I write on blogs and I write, and I'm not the only blogger, you know? And it's like, even that, and my brain will say, oh, that's a small thing. You don't have to write about the political atmosphere. Everybody's writing about it. Everybody's on Facebook. But it's not true, you know? I can write a small article. I can write a pamphlet and print it out old school and put it somewhere, you know? The writing does matter. And having these conversations, it does matter. And not so much to inspire like the other, you know, it matters because these ideas, these words that we're saying, you know, it creates something that carries, just like the negative politics carries and it affects us. It probes into us.
Well, I'm going to ask you a very leading question, and I hope that you use the opportunity to make a pitch and a plug. But for people that are feeling powerless, feeling despair, feeling like they need to have a voice, what role does the Human Rights Task Force play in that, and how can the public become involved in the actions of the task force?
That's a very good question. Okay, so you're asking, so how they can get their voice heard as well?
Yeah, if people are feeling outraged, does the Human Rights Task Force have an outlet for them to express themselves?
Right, that's okay. Well, I would say yes. I would say coming to the meetings, that energy, that spark, that the person shows up and it's like, well, let's focus on this, or what committee can I join? And since it's a reemergence of the group, we're, from what I've noticed, we're pretty open to like, okay, you want to do this? You want to, you know, come right here and do this action right here? Okay, let's do it, you know? So I think showing up, you know, everyone, you know, tells, well, I had a mentor who told me, you know, 80% of the job, just show up. Your mind doesn't even, you know, just show up and it'll be good.
Well, I want to touch on something that you mentioned that I thought was really great, and that, you know, we've talked a lot about the people who feel despair and are overcome with despair and feel like there's nothing that they can do. But there's also, and this is where I find myself a lot of the time, is it just a lot of it just feels pointless. It feels like nothing is going to, you know, matter. Even if I'm not despairing, it's like I can write, but everybody's writing. Mm-hmm. You know, I can, you know, go on Twitter and send rude words to my senator, but that's not gonna do anything, and that, frankly, probably wouldn't do anything. But you know, it's easy to treat it like it's a problem that isn't solved, but there's just, I can't do anything about it, so I'm just not gonna do this, and I'm not gonna do this, and I think that's important to have that. Damn that push. I think that was really mm-hmm. well said when you said that, to just do something.
Right, right. And it's something that like you said, it still occurs to me. It's like, what am I doing here? What's happening? But I'll just keep going.
And just to remind you that you are listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM and KAVZ 102.5 FM in Deming. We are joined today by actor and activist Teresa Williams. She's on the board of the re-emerging Whatcom Human Rights Task Force.
Yeah, and I know the history of the task force. It's got a great pedigree. It's been around for a long time. I think, if I'm not mistaken, and this is just off the top of my head, so I may be incorrect about this, but I think it had its genesis in some of the sort of extreme right-wing backlash that occurred in Whatcom County, you know, that sort of culminated in Timothy McVeigh's bombing of the Oklahoma City courthouse, or I'm not sure it was a courthouse.
And the local militia targeted Vernon Damani Johnson, who's a black Western Washington University
correct.
Professor.
Correct. And so there was a period of time, and I don't think it actually went away. I think it just went underground. But there was a period of time where there was this sort of county secessionist movement, this militia movement, Christian militia movements going on in Whatcom County, and it was becoming violent. And one author from Washington, D.C. wrote a book about it in terms of the right-wing hate groups that were concentrating in Whatcom County. And the task force set about to address that and to try to push back against that. And it's interesting that it's having a resurgence now, because that exact kind of pressure and political movement is on the move again.
Absolutely. And I was talking to somebody the other day about how it used to be on the right and the far right, guns, gays, and God, and now it seems to be Muslims, marriage, and medicine. but you're absolutely right. As the permission is granted overtly and covertly to these hate groups, and they get stronger, then the need becomes stronger.
Right. The rhetoric, it's making aggression okay, obviously, it's slowly chipping away at What is it chipping away at our sense of, not sense of dignity, but it's chipping away at what's acceptable and sugarcoating it with, oh, PC and all these other words, but it's not the truth. And then speaking truth to power, you know, we all say that, but speaking back, you know, and everybody's voice being able to speak back. And for those that can't or won't, are so beaten down, you know, just crushed in spirit, you know, you guys are here. You can speak for them. And that means something.
So here's the thing. You just said that it's chipping away at this sense of dignity. Maybe the bright side is that it's chipping away at our sense of denial. Because I think what Tim was hitting on is that it never went away. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to be tacitly permissive or ignorant of mm-hmm. things that are underground. We had a woman from the California head of the ACLU came up and talked about the militia groups and just how they've always been here. And it's not necessarily that their numbers have grown, their vocalness has grown. So if one good thing happens out of the situation that we're all living through right now is that maybe it's peeling away this thin veneer that everything's okay in Bellingham.
And, right. Yeah. And that's a good point. And then it goes to the issue of safety. And, you know, to bring it personal again, I took a road trip, you know, this summer, my son and I, and I started looking. So I was worried about going into different parts of the country, especially now. Then I start reading online different statistics and articles, and I saw about Whatcom County and the state of Washington actually has a vast number of hate groups, and it's like I should be more worried here.
Right. I'm reading an excellent book right now. It's called The Rise of the Alt-Right. It's by Dave Neuert, and Dave Neuert is a Northwest reporter and author, and he covered these hate groups back in that era that I was talking about earlier. It's a very difficult slog. It's a very difficult book to read. It's difficult for me to read, but the thing that's interesting to me about it is when he's talking about the rise of the alt-right, he's not talking about anything that has risen in Whatcom County. He is talking about the right wing in Whatcom County. I'm sorry that sounds bad, but he is talking about a mentality that is completely in control in right-wing politics in terms of the thinking that only counties are the only legitimate political authority in the United States. Only the sheriff is the only legitimate person involved in, it's the only legitimately elected individual. I mean, you read through this stuff and it's crazy, crazy, crazy town, but it is the thinking process of a lot of rural Whatcom County.
Yeah, and I am deep in the David Neuert tank.
Yes.
And if any of our listeners want to stay up all night, I highly recommend checking out his articles for Hate Watch, the Southern Poverty Law Center's blog. It is hair-raising stuff. I think that there's kind of a weird deception thing going with a little bit of this, because a lot of what we're seeing isn't all that new. It feels weird that all of a sudden, sexual assault is a political issue, and, you know, Nazism and Nazis marching in the street is a political issue. But this started a long time ago. I mean, you can go back a little bit. Shooting a 12-year-old in a park was suddenly a political issue. This became a partisan dividing thing. You know, you can see the lines in Baltimore with Freddie Gray and in Minnesota with Castile. This really started to galvanize in a deeply disturbing partisan manner. And I really feel like if we haven't gone over, we're right at the edge of a really bad cliff.
We're at that edge. And what you said earlier about the denialism and maybe kind of just going as business as usual. I was thinking about that earlier. We're at that edge, you know, and it feels safe to just act like we're not. And there's been other times in history where people were there. It tipped over. It tips over. I wish I could say it more eloquently, but
no, I mean, I don't want to use the cliche of crisis is opportunity, but we all are many of us are wrestling with our own helplessness and inability to find a voice and make it happen. But this is also an opportunity to maybe change some bigger issues. Mm-hmm. And we have a half hour left that we're going to hopefully get into some of that. But I do want to remind everybody that you are listening to Cascadia News Now with our guest activist and artist and activist Teresa Williams, who's on the board of the Human Rights Task Force. This is KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham, KAVZ 102.5. in Deming and Van Zandt. We've been talking a lot about the opportunities to join the Human Rights Task Force and why you did. When it started in the 90s, there weren't any other voices. Now, we are fortunate in this corner of the world to have many groups. We have Black Lives Matter in Bellingham. Mm-hmm. We have the Racial Justice Coalition. We have the Whatcom Civil Rights the legal civil rights group. We have Redline Salish Sea. And so I'm curious to know, now that you're having a resurgence with all of these other groups, how do you all fit in with each other?
That's a good question. How do we fit in with each other? I was thinking about that, having a type of more of a connection and I would say that, like, as far as like the Whatcom Human Rights Task Force, we are, you know, we were affiliated with the Peace and Justice Center, and so we're still working with them and other committees and groups. So we are in contact, not as far as I'm aware, not as close as it could be right now.
What and I don't mean to put you on the spot about this, but what is the crossover in membership? I mean, a person can be a member of the task force, they can be a member of Peace and Justice, they can be a member of the Democratic Party. Do you have any sense about, is there a synergy within the membership of these organizations?
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I've noticed in the attendance at the meetings, it's a diverse group. It's been times that we've had conversations, because we like to have real conversations and not just having the list in the committee. We have conversations like, what's going on? How are we going to respond to this specific event? This happened, and you know, in the world, what do we do about it? So we have these conversations, and sometimes we have the minority opinion, and not minority as in, you know, as far as like someone from a different political group, someone that you know, that's not I'm always hesitant to throw out terms. Everyone is involved in saying their, and then we listen and we disagree. And it's interesting.
And I don't mean to at all imply that there should be only one group. I think that that's mm-hmm. a very privileged place to be. Well, you know, why are there so many groups? I guess if somebody's on the outside feeling like they wanted to join a group, and maybe that's the work that you're doing in your upcoming meetings, is to establish, like, what is the work that the other groups are doing? What do we need to do, or how do we see the gaps, or what do we primarily?
I think that's a really good idea. I hadn't really thought about that so much, but it does make sense. Coming together more in numbers, and then a response back with, like, that's what I was thinking about this, or binding together, that's what we have to do.
Well, this maybe echoes back on something Dave was talking about, but I think that there's a sense of frustration that is deeply rooted in powerlessness of people. These things are happening every day. You read the newspaper, and there is something in there that how it's like the engagement of people, but also the empowerment of people. How do people become engaged and empowered, mm-hmm. do you think? And can they become engaged and empowered through these groups?
That's a good question. I would to go back to what happened with me. I was one of the ones on the outside. I was the one. Oh, I shouldn't say this. I was the one making fun of the people in groups and that got involved and that did things. Oh, it's so bad. I was the one that was like, nothing's gonna happen. Why are you? You know, I was that person. And what changed for me? you know, like I said, everything with the advent of the chaotic nature of things, but also, I guess it would be seeing specific examples. I saw people within these groups after I really kind of watched them and maybe watched, and I participated in a march, and I, you know, and I read an article or something. I was like, oh, this matters, you know, it does matter, and so. Now I lost track of the question.
But you bring up the most excellent point, Teresa, that I'm really glad you talked about your cynicism. I really am. I've been cynical, not to sound like a trope, but it was Obama that pulled me out because he mm-hmm. was the one who said, you know, cynicism isn't getting you anywhere, and I had mm-hmm. given up several mm-hmm. times. Cynicism kills us, and despair kills us, and that's kind of what they're banking on. So the fact that you can speak to that, remember how earlier you were saying, can I inspire people? Mm-hmm. I think being honest about the fact that it's easy to make fun of activists.
It is.
I guess what I would say is that one of the things that I would hope these organizations do is give some mechanisms so people can push through that feeling of helplessness or disempowerment or cynicism. And it's like, is there anything I can do
right
about this?
You mentioned Obama. I was thinking earlier about hope, you know, and he talked about hope and the audacity of hope and everything. And today I was like, I just, you know, I had a problem with that word for a while, hope. I was like, I know Obama said it, but, you know, hope right now. And so earlier I was thinking about heart. What about heart? And it's probably the same thing, but, you know, you spoke about, you know, the what do we do? And it's like maybe just having that, the heart, just keep,
Well, I hear you because I remember Cornel West was talking about his issues with hope, and it can be a passive term. Well, I hope mm-hmm. I hope we have good weather today. I hope somebody does something about that president. I mean, like, it's not active, and his issue or his idea was to talk about hope versus optimism optimism being a strong term, but heart really does get at, you know, if you care, you have to act, right? So so we've been talking a lot about the Human Rights Task Force. How does it fit in with the other organizations, how they can work together? You said it's going to be shaped by the people who were there, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
So Teresa, you're there. So let's give you the magic wand, and now you're you know, king of the world. What would you like to see change, and what would you like your actions to change?
I have the magic wand. Okay, what would I like to see change as far as in with that the group can do? What would I like to see? I would like to see the group come together with more members, more people showing up, and actually rolling our sleeves up and getting involved in the community in a way that is on a more personal level, as in, like, we have low-income families. What does that mean, low-income family? You know, that's a family that's struggling, that's having a hard time, that needs this, and, you know, we have schools and all of that. So what does that mean? Maybe the group goes and hosts an event that invites these families to a dinner or something and shows them, you know, I don't have all the answers, but my magic wand would involve the heart and involve people talking to each other, and more than just an associate level of hi and bye. It's like, let me bring you into my group. You know, I'm not a white person, but I'm a white person in Bellingham. Let me invite this low income family over to play in my yard. They don't even have a yard, you know, or not that they want to play in the yard, but you know what I mean, to dinner and then play in the yard, things like that.
Well, I think you're hitting on something we talked about in the first half of the show in terms of systemic change. And it's a dangerous precipice to walk on because it can lead back into feeling, you know, debilitated. And yet when somebody says, oh, well, you know, we have more women on the city council now, and that's great. And, oh, we have a person of color who's the president of Western Washington University, and that's great. But we're not digging into the systemic nature mm-hmm. of racism, homophobia, ageism, ableism, issues with prejudice against mental health. All of this goes back to the jail, obviously, too. Mm-hmm. But it's the kind of work that is really difficult and doesn't have a lot of visible change, I think, mm-hmm. right away.
Mm-hmm. Right. It would be, I guess that would be on an individual level. It wouldn't be that visible. It would be an individual, and it would be us making those connections with each other. That's how I would see it.
Well, I guess how I would, I guess I would push back a little bit on that. And we've talked about it a lot on the show. I'll use the word sanctuary. But I think Washington State has staked out a territory where even though there's like a great fall away, fallback, you know, collapse at the national level on some of these issues, Washington State, Oregon, Washington, California, they're kind of the big blue wall. We're going to continue to push forward on these issues. We're not going to roll back. We're actually going to move forward on them. I think that there's some jubilation, I think, among the left that the state Senate is in the hands now of Democrats to push forward on things like the capital budget. And we've talked about this also on the show, but not just to move forward on some issues, but to actually kill some really bad mm-hmm. things that came forward. And so I guess I would just resist it a little bit. I think that Washington, Oregon, the Blue Coast has staked out some terrain where it's not a complete collapse, and we're not going to have to rebuild from, like, I don't know, 100 years past, but we can move forward. We have marriage equality in the state that's very well founded. It's extremely well defended, and a number of other things. I'm interested in what you think, Dave.
Well, I think that is possible. You know, I have deep concerns about the structure of the blue wall and the weakness of the individual parties and members that make it up, because, you know, this is the sort of thing where, you know, this is a systemic problem, and the system is us, and that means we all have to do something. And that's something that, as people, we're not very good at. And, you know, keeping an eye on the prize of, like, we're going to make it at least where we can unacceptable to be hateful, to discriminate, to these things. Again, that's a tough goal. That's going to take a lot of work in those areas. And Oregon's got some real structural problems with that because of the way the state is laid out and the variety of opinions that exist in there. And here in Washington, you know, we don't have it quite to the same degree, but we do have a gigantic amount of hate groups.
Yep.
You know, you cannot go into the foothills of the Cascades, you know, without having a hate group within 10 miles of you.
And there are the two Washingtons.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to push back on your pushback.
Okay.
I hear you. And yes, and, you know, thank the stars for the blue wall, and it's gotten bluer and wallier, and that's great. There are people who feel very strongly that Bellingham is a crack in that wall, that Bellingham is not as strong as the rest of Washington. And you said the word sanctuary, so you opened the door for me to bring up the fact that we are not a sanctuary city in a place where there are a lot of conservative cities, more conservative than Bellingham, that had no problem calling themselves a sanctuary city. And that there are a lot of complaints that, great, we took the picket bridge sign down. Great, we have a Bellingham flag. And it's great that we passed this ordinance, but that these are cosmetic changes. And that there is concern, and I share that concern, that our city council and our local government is a little gun-shy about taking the strong stand that Jay Inslee and our hero Ferky, Bob Ferguson, seem to take without any problem. You want to weigh in on that, or it's a lot?
Let's see. I'll start at the end. Taking a strong stand. What does that mean for Bellingham and the Bellingham City Council? And what does that mean? You know, they're our representatives. They move when we move, or supposedly. So taking a strong stand, you know, what does Bellingham stand for? Yeah, lately I've been watching a little more closely some of the policies, and I show up at some of the city hall meetings, and I kind of just sit in the back and I look, and I find myself wondering if we believe what we say, and if any changes are going to be made that are actually helpful to the populace and helpful to the communities that are disenfranchised, and not even the maybe not even just them, you know, the whole community. And what do you know? Are we a facade? What do we stand for, Bellingham? And I know it's great people here. I've been living here. You know, I know what's going. So it's what are, whoa, yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Stephanie. I think you're absolutely right that there, and you've used some great words. There is a cosmetic.
I use word goods.
Yeah,
words good.
Yeah, you do. there's a cosmetic facade. Maybe it's easy to just resist, you know, these impulses and call it good, call it a day. But actually, no, you have to much more aggressively push back on some of them. And I agree that Bellingham has not done that. Bellingham has been extremely risk averse, mm-hmm, in some of these things. They haven't pushed forward. There are true issues of income, racial disparity that occur in Bellingham, and there's this kind of a feel-good thing. So I agree with that. Actually, I think you raised a great point, which is that in the midst of what I would consider national crisis, Bellingham's pretty complacent.
Well, thank you, Tim. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I just want to point out that about 20 years ago, Seattle was in the exact same space. You know, they had a city council that was weak, that was, you know, really concerned with their own image and how they were going to look and didn't want to do anything. And the people of Seattle changed that. And, you know, our representatives are our responsibility. We don't get to just elect them and then let them go. If they are not being who we need them to be, that's on us. That's not about them. We're not making them.
Right. And I mean, frankly, this last election, nobody ran against any of these people. So, mm-hmm, there's no pressure on them. It's like, please, let's get an operational democracy so that there's some pressure on our elected officials to do better, because they weren't challenged in this last election at all. Really?
Teresa, I'd like to offer right here, right now on live radio, to be your campaign manager.
Yes.
For me.
At such a time that you have stopped being cynical about our city council and are ready to run for that.
I accept that.
You got my vote.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me credit, Tim. There are groups that are talking about these issues constantly. I have to use this opportunity to say that some of the things that I think about and some of my perspective is shaped by groups like the Racial Justice Coalition, Community, Red Line, Salish Sea. And because I'm here also as the program director of KMRE, that I want to point out that we do have a show, if these issues are important to you, that is called Community Voice. And it's on Saturdays and Tuesdays and Thursdays, where people from Red Line Salish Sea, Community to Community, Bellingham Racial Justice Coalition, Black Lives Matter, get together and bring up issues that people aren't hearing. And without programs and without radio like KMRE, mm-hmm, we wouldn't have shows like that. And these perspectives wouldn't come out. And I think we're lucky. I can be pretty self-satisfied with the show that we do here at Cascadia News Now. Thank you all. And thank you to my co-hosts. But we are not maybe as radical as some voices, or as unheard, or as unsupported as some perspectives and voices. The reason I'm bringing this up is because KMRE has to find a new home. We've been at the Spark Museum for a long time, and Spark is growing. And so they've asked us to find a new home. That also means we have to become independent, and we are no longer going to be under their wing. If we do not raise a certain amount of money, we will not exist. Cascadia News Now will not exist. Community Voice will not exist. Local radio dramas that are created here will not exist. And our community and our voices will be lost and sadder for it. So,
and the very frequency that the radio station operates on will be lost.
That's right. And there's a few, just a small handful of low-powered licenses that were given to communities, which is good. You're hitting on my segue. But if we don't maintain this license, not only will it disappear, but looking at the current FCC, it will never be handed out to a community.
Correct.
Ever again.
Yeah, and this is the sort of, you know, thing that a lot of communities don't get. You know, we are very lucky in this town to have outlets for local media and someplace where people can go and learn about it and do something and be involved. And I think we are very blessed to have it. And I hope that it's important to everyone else, too.
So please go to savekmre.org. That's savekmre.org. And here's the thing. Just like with any election that is a grassroots election, I don't care if you're like me and you're struggling to make ends meet. If you're somebody like Jim Swift, and Jim Swift, I hope you're listening, we would love to have a few thousand dollars. But if you're like me and you don't have a few thousand dollars, if you make a $5 donation, we're going to be looking at the number of people, and the number of people who speak up is as important as the amount of money that they give.
Right. $5 makes a difference. It adds up.
Right. I guess, you know, we're at an interesting moment. I've been talking to people about this. We're at an interesting moment where, I mean, the word plutocracy, we throw it around a lot, but it's really becoming the new paradigm for the country. The public used to own the airwaves. It used to belong to them. It is being snapped up more and more. We have the issue of net neutrality that is going on with the FCC. You know, it's interesting. And getting back to the Human Rights Task Force, at the end of Martin Luther King Jr.'s life, he began to understand that what really the issue was. And he only began to think about this before his life was ended, but that it was not a race issue, but a class issue, and that really faced the United States. And I think it's becoming a crisis mode where we're actually actively engaged in a class war, where our institutions and our public airwaves and our public waterways, all those are up for grabs. And I don't know where I'm quite going with my comments, but I really think people need to think very deeply about the fact that their country is like sand under their feet and changing under their very eyes very quickly.
Well, I know where you're going, and that is that there are terrible people who want to sell this country off for parts. And KMRE is a part that you can save.
That was a good one.
And that's why he is the politician in the room. but you really are, Tim. You're knitting everything together. And there's the issue of class, but especially these days, we could say that the issue is about gender. And boy, if a whole echelon, no offense, guys, but if a whole echelon of men weren't in power, we wouldn't be having these crises in Hollywood and in politics and everywhere, too. You can look at any angle, and that's where intersectionality comes in, which I am throwing back to you, Teresa, because I think intersectionality has to be a question that every organization sort of has to address.
Mm-hmm. Describe that just quickly, though, intersectionality.
I'm going to leave that to you.
Oh,
to you,
okay. I was thinking with intersection. Oh, sorry. Hit the mic. Intersectionality is bringing together all of these different categories and making sure that we address them all and don't fall into divisiveness. And I was thinking about earlier, you mentioned the chaos and how there's opportunity in that. I thought of the chrysalis, and, you know, just to get poetic for a moment, there's a chrysalis, you know, and there's a cocoon, there's a butterfly, and all of these things. We don't want to kill the butterfly. We can kill the butterfly if we start dividing and, you know, cutting up the cocoon, and here's a race, here's a woman, you know, let's bring it all together, you know, and let's see what we can do together.
Well, I think that it's a good start, and I think it's probably intersectionality being that exact thing where you have to look at how, for instance, in our jail, when we talk about the people who are representing certain racial ethnicities in our jail versus the people that we have in our population, but you cannot extract that from how much money people make and what class they have, or how many people who are in our jail have mental health issues that can't get. That's what intersectionality is that these are all different pieces. And I think, bringing this back to the Human Rights Task Force, that there is a reason that different organizations have to focus on a different piece. But at the same time, organizations kind of have to have a broader mindset than they did 20 years ago.
Is it useful to for people that are interested in social change to try to determine the biggest bucket in which all of, there's agreement, or is actually or is it important to keep all of these concerns separate in some conceptual way so that their issues are addressed properly?
Well, when you start to separate, I think that comes down to, this is hard to talk about, the identity, you know, and holding so fast to a certain identity and like, this is my issue, this is what I'm going to talk about. I'm trying to see how to pull it together. Like, take someone that's in jail, you know, and they have mental health and maybe a low income status or maybe not. But let's just take that scenario. When you start partitioning and sectioning off, you know, it's how do you get the whole picture, the holistic view? I think you have to look at the whole person.
Well, I think, you know, and to expand on the chrysalis thing. Now, there's no point in a chrysalis that is half caterpillar and half butterfly. The caterpillar is gone completely and remade. And, you know, in that moment, in that mess, that's what you need to get the butterfly. And, you know, trying to separate that and break that apart into distinct, well, this is more important than this thing, I don't think is productive. I don't think it's going to get us where we want to go.
And we don't have time to get there anyway, which is sad because I would love to have a conversation about what happens inside that chrysalis, which I just found out about, and it's really gross. We'll save that for another time.
Yes.
So please go to the Human Rights Task Force and get involved. This has been a fantastic show. Teresa, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest was Teresa Williams from the Whatcom Human Rights Task Force with me, Stephanie Contouris, Dave Willingham, and Tim Johnson. I am the producer of the show, and Devlin Sweeney is our fantastic engineer. Thank you so much, Devlin. And Dave Willingham is our technical director and editor. Very appreciated. Find us on Cascadia News Now on the Facebooks. Find our archives or get in touch with us at cascadianewsnow.com. But if you remember one reference tonight, please make that reference be safecamre.org. You are listening to Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming and KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham.